You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
This is Tanya Pinkins with my You Can't Say That podcast on the Broadway Podcast Network. It's a joke amongst many black folks that if a white person is smiling when they start speaking to you, some bad shit is about to go down. I found most Northern progressives to be excellent at performing tolerance, but their words cannot mask the repressed resentment at political correctness. Sometimes they fooled themselves, but not me. I think people who lack self-awareness are very dangerous. But my next guest is a white guy who I actually think gets his privilege, doesn't apologize for it, owns it, and uses it to serve helping those who, but for the color of their skin, might have excelled far beyond him. I have been given the dream opportunity to get and sit and listen to people tell me about their lives, one of my favorite things. And so sometimes it's people I haven't seen in a long time, and from the minute they walk in the door, we start talking, and Dory barely has the chance to catch us. So today you have my friend Ron Russell from Epic Next, and you're just gonna have to catch up because we started talking and the recorder came in after. Welcome, Ron Russell.
Good stuff.
It's really crazy. Funnily, what I realized the other night was this whole insane high school system in New York is a great example of the impact on an entire system of deeply embedded institutional racism, right? That is like, you know, I was Ibram Kendi. Do you know his stuff? He wrote a book called Stamp from the Beginning that I think you would love. It's really research-based. It's a sort of a definitive history of racist ideas. But his new book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, he says this thing like we're left in a culture of racism with no racists. I mean, he's exaggerating, of course, right? But this idea of like this whole system, this whole crazy high school system was built by racism for racists, right? That's why it exists the way that it does. And if arguably some of that is gone and you don't see it on the surface, it's still the whole thing is just about keeping people separated. That's what it's all for. And it's all been built by people, many probably with the right intentions to like try to rectify that. But you make these little changes and it just makes it worse and worse and worse. So
give me an example. You said right now you're in the high school process. What is that? What is the high school application process?
So you've got, you got to choose 12, up to 12 high schools. Right. To go to, you pick, right. And they call it, you know, student choice because you get to choose your 12. It makes sense if the entire system were just lottery based.
Okay.
That would make a lot of sense. If everything was just a pure lottery, you'd pick the 12 that you want and you'd hope the algorithm works out or whatever number it would need to be to make that work out. Maybe it's bigger, maybe it's 16, maybe it's 8. But it's not. The whole system is rigged with every one of the schools in Manhattan that are schools that have interesting and rich programs. Forget about whether or not they have good test scores or not, but just like do something other than just dumb old style education. Every one of those schools, 90% of those schools are set up with all of these restrictions and rules, right?
Where they, give me some examples.
So like, for instance, to get into the iSchool, there's a rubric that gives you a certain number of points for what you got on the state math test, what you got on the state ELA test, what you got on each of your four main subjects in seventh grade, attendance, right? So every time you had an absence, you lose X number of points, right? Those points are all put into this giant rubric, right, figured out, and then they say, okay, well, here is the 130 kids we're going to offer admission to, starting with the one whose point score was the highest, right? And they go through then and offer those people admission. Now, when they look at Imogen, my daughter's sheet, they start with her number one. They take her number one and they try to see if that matches up with, did they invite her to a slot?
Okay.
Does that make sense? So that's why you have to list 12. Because if your first one, they didn't invite you, then they go to your second one, then they go to your third one. But the way that the whole thing is set up is makes it extremely difficult to make any kind of coherent choice, because if you know there's only 26 slots available at school X, right, this school that you want to go to, and your point score isn't perfect, right, which very few kids are, you don't have any idea how many kids are applying, what they're going to pick. Do you get what I'm saying? So suddenly what happens is you're just really guessing. You're just guessing based on like, well, I hope this works out. And so as a result, it's sort of painful to go through the process of watching. My daughter has a very, very low math score. Everything else very high. She's a very low math score. And by their standards, I don't think it's particularly low, but by their standards, it's very low. So she is consistently being penalized for that math score at schools who state that their values are things that she would absolutely be the right fit for. Do you know what I mean? So the standardized tests then are taking an unbelievably large role in this, even though there's absolutely no proof that they have any impact on whether kids do well in high school. In fact, it's proven that you can't really track those two things at all, right? And they know that, and they would say that, and yet they're holding up this image of what matters to them. Now, Richard Carranza, the new school's chancellor, what he's doing is he's going in and he's saying, segregation in this city, educational segregation has to end. This is the most segregated city in America.
Is it one now? Because it used to be Chicago, and this was number two. We're number one now. Okay.
We're number one. Woo! We are the most segregated educational system in the country. And so when what he's trying to do is get these schools, some of these schools that have the right values, to commit to 60% of their students being low-income students, right, beneath a certain income level, which is fantastic. I'm all for it. It's Epic Next. Our youth company participates in this work with him and with Integrate NYC. But it's beginning to feel to me like, why don't we just really fix it? Like, why don't we just fix the whole thing by just utterly randomizing it completely? And then every school in this city would have a population that is representative of the city. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, and then, people wouldn't like that.
I know. And then guess what would have to happen is the schools would have to actually get equitable resources to make that work. Right?
Yeah,
but they're never going to do that.
Yeah, no, that's not going to happen.
You know what I mean? So it's like, it feels a little bit like this daring thing that Carranza is doing, that the Post is ripping all of our partners a new, you know, for.
You can say asshole.
Okay, I can say asshole. Right? Everybody's getting their assholes ripped for reverse racism, one of my least favorite phrases, whatever the hell reverse racism is. So,
yeah, exactly. What is that?
Pointing inwards. I don't know. I have no idea. But anyway, they're being torn up about this because he has been just going through the entire rank of everybody in the schools and saying, you're biased. I'm sorry. You've been in the system too long and you think this is right. And you're not the best person for the job, and you bring a lot of bias into the job.
Wow.
Right?
And he's just firing people.
And firing them. And,
wow.
And so, you know, that's not very popular. But then this idea that he's going to somehow fix it with this low-income maneuver, right? I mean, really, like 6 months ago, I thought that was brilliant. But now that I'm actually doing the system as a parent, I'm like, that is so like nicking around the edges. That's he's just messing about a little bit. They're only going to be about 10% of the schools that have agreed to do it.
Oh, so doing this low income thing is not going to apply to everybody? They have to agree?
Yeah.
Why do they have to agree?
That's
my government
point.
Organization.
Why don't you tell them that they're doing it?
Well, that's strange. It's interesting to me because I went to Whitney Young High School in Chicago. Have you ever heard of it?
Yes.
Whitney Young was a magnet school, one of the first big magnet schools, and they built it on the west side of Chicago. They spent a lot of money. I guess I'm out of high school now. Oh my God. A long time, 30 or 40 years. I went to school with Michelle Robinson. She was an underclassman. Michelle Obama, for those of you who, she wasn't that then. But it was built on that model of, we were moving this school into a very poor neighborhood. And so a percentage of those students were guaranteed placement in the school. It also had a school for deaf or hearing impaired was the terminology at the time. And the school was built on trying to maintain this racial and economic balance for all the students. And it consistently has really, really high test scores. So, you know, I guess I have a sort of bias towards that kind of program because that's the kind of program I think I got into. Though definitely high test score people could get into that school as well. But it was like you couldn't not let people who lived in that community go to that school. Right. They had the right to go to that school because it took over their community.
Right. And I think that that's what a fully randomized system would do. It would give everybody real choice. You know, you could pick based on geography. You could pick based on something like this school has a cooler arts program than this other school. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You could pick because you heard they have a great math teacher. You could pick because your cousin went there and loved it, mm-hmm. right? You just pick, right?
Yeah, I think that people try to do things easy. Like, is it Daniel Pink who wrote Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow? And he says, we're just always looking for the easy yeah. solution. I feel that way as a teacher at NYU. We now have a policy that we have to ask all of our students on day one, what is your pronoun?
Right.
And it doesn't tell you anything about a person at all. But right, now yeah. we've solved that problem. We don't have to worry about discriminating against anybody because of their gender, because we ask them their pronoun. And it's like, no, actually, it's a lot more complicated than that.
Do you feel like the world has become in your lifetime much more concerned with covering its ass? Like, because I can't shake that feeling, and I'm sure I'm wrong. I'm sure it was just as much cover your ass going on when I was 20 and I just didn't see it. But it just feels like that's that everything we do and running a business, it makes me insane. Sexual harassment being like the big thing right now. The endless compliance that my company has to do around sexual harassment, not that it changes anything.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
All I'm doing is filling out paperwork.
I had this argument at a big meeting with the unions. They were sitting there and I was an elected at the time, and they were like, okay, well, we'll get people to watch a video and we'll get people to take yeah. a test, and then we'll get right. them to sign this paper and we'll get them to sign that paper. And everybody patted everybody on the back and was like, look what we're doing. And then, you know, I'm that, you know, the sore thumb, the thorn in everybody's side. I'm like, well, you know, I happen to be a person who, when I am being sexually harassed, I freeze. So I could have read all of your papers and signed yeah. them and done all of the videos. And in the moment that it is happening to me, I leave my body. There is nothing I can do.
Right.
So I don't think I'm alone in that. So what is all these programs going to do for
right.
me? And
right.
so there was just this silence, and literally people just tried to avoid me for the rest of the day because I had ruined the whole right. plan that they had solved sexual harassment.
Right.
And the one plan that I did put forward, which was, and I put it out to the members of Actors Equity. I put it out to the members because I knew the elected would not go for it. Mm. It was to create a third party online platform that would allow people to report sexual harassment
right.
in a encrypted way mm-hmm. where they could release the burden for themselves. And then they were free to not do anything until they wanted to. But the way the system worked was if someone else was also harassed by that person, they would get a notification and it would say,
gotcha.
Do you want to go for, do you want to proceed? Do you want to meet that person?
Right.
And always putting the power in the hands of the person. And to me, the beauty of that is that there are people who are carrying these kind of burdens for 50 or 60 years.
Yeah.
There was one union
yeah.
leader I met with who told me that one of their members called and said, you know, when 50 years ago I went in for an audition and a producer took off his shirt. And she just thought, well, why is he telling me that? And I'm like, well, he's been carrying that for 50 years.
Right.
And taking off your shirt
yeah.
50 years ago is different than taking off your shirt today. And wow, if he had a place he could have put that and not be carrying the burden, and it might have helped somebody else, because
yeah.
abusers don't stop.
Right, exactly.
It keeps going on. But the members voted overwhelmingly for that kind of system to be implemented and funded, and the electeds voted it down in favor of having a, what was it, a president's committee to talk about it.
Right, exactly.
You know, they do a lot
exactly.
of talking about things. We talk about it, and
yeah.
I don't know that there's really a commitment to a solution.
Right, I agree. I mean, just recently going through a new protocol for NYU, and NYU is not alone in this. It just happens to be the one I know about, because we're doing a program with minors there, and NYU students, grad students, would be mentoring those minors,
mm-hmm.
right? So this, just what I just said, becomes an extremely complicated wasp's nest for lawyers.
Mm.
Because you've got, not only do you have outside adults and outside minors coming in, you're also nexusing with people who go to school there,
mm-hmm.
right? So it creates this kind of crazy web of potential lawsuits and liability, right? And so in the middle of the process, which took about 6 months to make it possible, and no small amount of money that needed to be added to all these insurance riders that everybody had to be signed off on, it just became really, really clear that in none of this was there any concern about the students. There wasn't anything about the young people. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
None of this was protecting them in any meaningful way. What it was protecting was when the lawsuit happened or when compliance was violated, then it was protecting NYU.
Mm-hmm.
right? It was arguably, they would say, I know what the lawyers would say, they'd say, no, you're protecting Epic. That's true too, but I don't really, if someone on my staff in some way endangers a minor, I don't want to be protected. That's certainly not the first thing I'm going to think of. Mm-hmm. I'm going to want justice. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And if it turns out that my company was not clear, that we do not allow that, or my oversight was not good enough to catch that person, we should close.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
I like it.
I mean, that's just...
I like that kind of accountability.
Do you get what I'm saying?
I do.
I don't need a lawyer to help me make sure I don't have to close because someone hurt a child in my presence. I mean, come on. Like,
yes, you know I'm what with I mean? You.
So.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Anyway.
Yeah, no, that's going to bring me to my introduction because I don't know how this will be edited together and nobody knows who I'm talking to and why we're talking about what we're talking about. But my name is Tanya Pinkins, and as you can tell, we are saying some things that you don't hear very often. My guest is Ron Russell. He is the Epic co-founder, executive director, and site manager at BHSWCA. What is that?
And that's one of the high schools that Epic founded, co-founded.
Can you tell us what that acronym is?
Yeah, it stands for Bronx High School for Writing and Communication Arts. We call it Bushwaka.
And his co-founder is his wife, Melissa Friedman.
Correct.
And I should have had her here. We'll have to give her her own time. But I figured since you all run a company that is in high schools, we needed one of you at a time. Ron has an MFA in directing from Louisiana State University, a BA in neuroscience theater from Oberlin College. After founding the nationally acclaimed Summer Theater Enrichment Program at El Centro de Servicios in Lorain, Ohio, Ron came to New York as education director at Theater for a New Audience. There, from 1996 to 2001, Ron administered one of the nation's most in-depth programs for introducing New York City public school students to Shakespeare, serving over 25,000 students during his tenure, and he created new programming, including the playwriting program at Project Renewal, an assisted living facility for homeless men. He has also directed extensively in New York City, including 15 off-Broadway productions, 14 for Epic, including most recently James Wallert's The Winning Side, Nalaja Sun's Pike Street, and Kate Fodor's Hannah and Martin. Epic's productions have reached over 200,000 audience members in New York City, across the nation, and abroad, including over 30,000 high school students and nearly 20,000 first-time adult theatergoers. Asking challenging questions about American politics, history, and ethics, Epic's youth company, Epic Next, has now reached over 35,000 audience members with new work devised from research and interviews about issues of educational inequity and segregation in New York City, empowering families, educators, and policymakers to take actions. Ron's classroom experience includes over 15 educational sites, and his work as an educator in New York City has been recognized by citations from Municipal Arts Society and Mayor Giuliani and Bloomberg. Welcome, Ron Russell. That was
you.
A mouthful right there.
Yeah, sorry about that.
But what an impressive resume. I didn't even know all these things about you. When I think of you, I remember meeting you, I think, at a panel that was at the Signature Theater on diversity in American theater. And, you know, I've come to Epic and done some work with the students. And what I often think of you as, I think of you as kind of one of the most woke white men I know. No, and that really does mean a lot to me, because I often say I would prefer a Southern racist to a Northern liberal any day, because a Southern racist is really clear. They have clarity. And when someone has clarity, they are trustworthy. Mm. You can trust them to be who they are and to act according to their values and their beliefs. And oftentimes, I feel that people who want to call themselves progressive are lacking in clarity. Mm. And so therefore they are not trustworthy, because if you push one of those emotions or resentments that they have, they're going to act according to the emotional thing that's coming up rather than to any kind of clarity they have about things. Mm. So, you know, I feel like when you talk to me about your upbringing and your experiences, I don't feel that you are repressing resentments. I don't feel like you are, you know, giving me shame or guilt or political correctness about what you're talking about. My experience of you is that you walk your talk. And so tell us a little about your background in New Orleans. And I know there was a friend of yours that you talk about and the difference between the outcome of your life and the outcome of his.
Yeah, I am a Southern racist. I think that's the right way to say it, because that stuff doesn't go away. Mm. It doesn't just disappear. I definitely grew up, and this is no diss on my parents or any of my family, I grew up in a dream in which white people had supremacy. And that dream was, you know, to use like Baldwin's quote, the people who believe they are white. I believed I was white. And I believe that afforded me not only the privileges that I kind of knew I was getting even when I was young, but it afforded me the ability to, argue that those privileges were deserved. Mm. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. As opposed to just get them and be like, well, that sucks that I got privilege there, but I'm going to take it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I think a lot of times that's what drives me crazy about Northern liberals, is this idea that they want to argue that they earned their way.
That there's a meritocracy involved.
That there's a meritocracy involved, or that they've always had black friends and invited black people into their home when that was dangerous to do so, and all that crap that I'm just like, okay, cool. But let's just admit it. Like, white people grow up in this kind of a dream of supremacy. I'm sure some don't, but I don't know any.
Well, I mean, I imagine that people in Appalachia, you know, like the people Lucy Thurber writes about, they didn't grow up that way. And from what she's told me, they grew up in the same way that we as black people. I mean, like, you think about the fact that poor white people, that's where cracker comes from.
Yeah.
You know, elitist white people calling poor white people crackers.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you're probably right. So I guess, Lucy Thurber is a really good example. Someone who speaks very well about that. So, when I grew up, in New Orleans and Baton Rouge, and I had a close friend who, his mother and my mother were in this sort of very odd relationship that you find a lot in the South, where she was what we called our maid, but that's not her job description. Her job was sort of being my mom's best friend. From my mom's perspective, I don't know what she thought. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't actually have any idea what her view of the relationship was. I'm not going to try to put myself in that. But she was kind of my mom's support system, I guess. Maybe best friend's the wrong way to say it, but like support system. And my mom had a lot of trouble with my dad, and they were separated. And so,
did she get paid for her being a support system for best friend?
She did. Okay. She did. That was her job, I guess. I don't know. Again, I'm not one to speak on that kind of complicated relationship, but, she had a son, same age as me. We went to the same schools, growing up. For a while, until, of course, my white privilege kicks in and I am given the chance to go to opportunities that he's not given a chance to because of geography, probably. But you know what I mean, was the excuse that they gave. He didn't live in the right area. But definitely it would have had to do with the color of my skin. I don't remember there being anyone except this one guy named Enoch in the program that I went to. I should say, context-wise, the schools that I went to were terrible schools. They were just terrible schools because we lived in the poor neighborhood.
Okay.
Right. They were just garbage schools. So they had a program for gifted and talented kids, right, that allowed you to, within that crap school, have a better teacher.
Okay. Like,
3 days a week or something like that. You get what I mean? Yeah. And as it grew in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, this is when we were living in Baton Rouge, as that grew in Baton Rouge, more and more opportunities presented themselves. So the thing about this young man that I grew up with was that he was a really straight-laced kid. He was like the good kid. He always got good grades. We spent a lot of time together in and out of all through middle school, but we saw each other some in high school. But it was funny because he ran with this very clean-cut crowd, very much about getting good grades and going to college and all this conversation. And I was a terrible kid. I mean, I was one of the worst kids you can imagine. I was such a little jerk, and no one wanted me at their school. I got kicked out of several high schools. I left sophomore year with just like a couple of credits. I had like just a few credits. You know what I mean? Again, and so what I always talk about is the fact that like nobody's going to let a white kid have that happen to them in Louisiana.
Yeah, you're not falling through the cracks.
I'm not going to fall through the crack. There's like endless trampolines down there when you do slip. You know what I mean? It goes on forever. It's like an infinity of nets. And so they ended up kind of rescuing me. In my case, it was by going to this boarding school that I went to, Louisiana School for Math, Science, and the Arts, which was in northern Louisiana. And, you know, I'm sure from their perspective, I earned my way into it. I took all these tests and did all these interviews, and they were like, oh, you're so bright, and we're going to save you. You know what I mean? But again, when I think back on that experience at that school, there were 400 students there. I don't think ever during the 2 years I was there, there was more than two African-American students. There was some diversity around Asian students and students who had, like, Indian students. There were several Indian students there, but I don't remember. I remember one African American young woman. I think she had a friend. but that's kind of Louisiana back then, especially northern Louisiana. He and I lost touch. And about 5 years after I left Louisiana for good, I found out through my mom that he was on death row for a murder that is just almost inconceivable to me how that could have shook out. And I did some research to try to figure out, well, where did this start? I mean, you don't just up and murder someone, I don't think. There was a history. There were problems that occurred when he left college under some sort of mysterious circumstances. Do you know what I mean? I don't even have to go through the whole story. Basically, he was not in a position, for whatever reason, to have the kind of advantages that I had had. And I don't know if he committed the crime or not. I have no idea.
Right.
He's no longer on death row.
Did he survive death row?
He survived death row.
He got exonerated.
Yeah. The evidence, I guess, I don't know exactly what happened in terms of the exoneration, but he was spared death. He's still in prison.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, like, we're all, I think, so much more than the worst thing we've ever done in our lives.
Right.
And I did a play written by Alexandre Camon called Time Alone out in LA. And I met a lot of young people who had murdered people.
Yeah.
And through some programs that the governor put through, these kids were out. And they were men now. So many of them had spent half their life in prison. And they were really nice people. Like, I had an idea of what a murderer
would
is.
Be.
And then you meet these people. And they're just people. And they're nice people. And they're talented people. And they're smart people. And they're funny people. And, we make this idea of what a murderer is.
Yeah.
You know, I like to think, even just as an artist, that anything a human being is capable of, I'm capable of.
Right.
So I could
be
a murderer, too.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. No, and exactly. And I think the story only makes sense to me. And the only reason I use it is just to speak about the fact that there is really legit no reason why I should be in the position that I'm in. I was below... I think a lot of white men get to where they are just by basically hiding in and being mediocre and no one calling them out on it. Do you know what I mean?
I'm glad you said that.
Because they're just white men. But I was not mediocre. I was extraordinarily bad. Do you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like I was coasting.
I'm not going to even believe that because you have accomplished so much in your life.
I'm telling you. I was bad. I was a bad, bad kid.
Thank you for listening to part one of my interview with Ron Russell. Part two is coming up next.
Thanks for listening to You Can't Say That with Tanya Pinkins, part of the Broadway Podcast Network. This episode was produced by Dori Berenstein, edited by Alan Seals, with music by Anthony Norman. You can find more information and other great Broadway-related podcasts via broadwaypodcastnetwork.com/youcantsaythat.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.